If it becomes difficult being dear Eve, you have these other ladies to assist you.
What is your team?
Oh, we're called AAS, which stands for Actuarial and Accountancy Service.
That's almost too boring a title.
Can I give you some advice? When you get to London, first thing you do is find somewhere, a bolt hole, a place that only you know about. Don't tell anyone, hmm? Not even me. Roma rule. There are lots of Roma rules. And the most important Roma rule of all is this. Don't trust anyone. Perhaps that's the only real rule. You can't trust anyone. You must always suspect, mistrust. Okay? I have a little job for you. A real job. Not dangerous.
Not dangerous. Or not that dangerous.
We'll see.
Restless by William Boyd was dramatised by Melissa Murray. Sally and Eve were played by Eileen Atkins, Ruth by Fenella Woolgar, Lucas Roma by Adrian Lucas, Hamid by Akbar Kurta, and the teacher, Philip Fox. And the story continues tomorrow afternoon at 2:30.
The Digital Station on radio, TV and online. BBC Radio 4 Extra.
Episode 2 of The Wings of the Dove by Henry James is the 60-minute drama at 3 o'clock. Before that, more from a former Book of the Week from August 2011, Now All Roads Lead to France, an exploration of the making of one of Britain's most influential First World War poets, Edward Thomas, who is perhaps best remembered for his poem Adelstrop. Matthew Hollis's biography is an account of Thomas's final 5 years and of his momentous and mutually inspiring friendship with the American poet Robert Frost. It's read by Tobias Menzies.
The day after the opening of the Poetry Bookshop in January 1913, Edward Thomas had returned to Steep in Hampshire, where a New Year's greetings card lay in wait. It was an introductory correspondence from a young, naive socialite who had become his confidant. This was Eleanor Fargen, 31 years of age, who had sent him a goodwill message emblazoned with a sailing ship. He took this teasingly as an invitation from her to what he called lessons in navigation at their upcoming social gathering in Broughton Gifford, Wiltshire. It was a coquettish, even flirtatious response from Thomas. Yet, beneath the surface, he yearned for all the navigation he could get. Eleanor was a quiet, shy, bespectacled woman who thought herself unnoticeably plain. By the time she met Thomas, she had already published 2 volumes of poems. It was said of her that when she wrote, she smiled, and it would not be long before she would fall in love with Edward Thomas, the writer and the man. Robert Frost had marked his arrival in England with a pale lyric about the pleasures of experiencing the English maritime. For the breeze was a watery English breeze, always fresh from one of the seas. But it was the need to find a publisher for his existing poems that motivated him more than the new work. Then, in March 1913, his debut, A Boy's Will, was published by David Nutt. Unfortunately, the notices were not what he hoped. One read, "The writer is not afraid to voice the simplest of his thoughts and fancies, though the thought may be feebly or obscurely expressed." Better notices followed, but few seemed to get beneath the skin of the poems, and fewer still were moved to outright praise. That June, the English newspapers carried accounts of renewed troubles in the distant Balkans. With the ink barely dry on the first treaty, a second Balkan war had broken out that would take the death toll to 150,000. But the event seemed a long, long way from England. In 1913, Nobody could foresee the distance these sparks would carry. Certainly not Edward Thomas, who at that moment could barely see beyond his writing desk. He had written, rewritten and typed In Pursuit of Spring, an account of a bicycle ride from London to the Quantocks, and he might have felt some joy at finishing his most coherent prose book yet, but instead he was exhausted. Helen tried to keep out of his way, but sparked his temper in remarking that he looked tired. "Tired is not what I am," he snapped. "I am sick of the whole of life, of myself chiefly, of you and the children. I despise myself for not putting an end to it." The summer days of 1913 were not happy ones for Robert Frost either, but the sting of those early reviews of A Boy's Will and their charge of simplicity stirred him into outlining a theory of his poetry. He would call it the sound of sense. Simply stated, Frost's belief was this: cadence is a natural part of human speech. It gives the speaking voice its intonation, its modulation, and its rhythm. We use cadence to indicate and understand meaning in a way that goes deeper than the content of individual words, into the arena of moods and atmospheres. So when, in Frost's favourite example, we hear voices behind a closed door, we can broadly make out sense, even if the words themselves are not clear. In this way, a line of verse can communicate tonally as well as through the literal definition of the words. As Frost was soon to discover, Edward Thomas had been thinking along the very same lines. In the summer of 1913, Frost was writing many of his finest poems, Home Burial, Mending Wall, and the masterful Birches. "I'd like to get away from Earth a while, and then come back to it and begin over. May no fate willfully misunderstand me and half grant what I wish and snatch me away not to return. Earth's the right place for love. I don't know where it's likely to go better. I'd like to go by climbing a birch tree and climb black branches up a snow-white trunk toward heaven, till the tree could bear no more but dipped its top and set me down again. That would be good both going and coming back. One could do worse than be a swinger of birches." In October 1913, Frost and Thomas finally met for the first time at the St. George's Cafe off St. Martin's Lane in London, in a room that mingled the scent of coffee with, as one guest remembered, the reek of half a hundred pipes. Curiously, nothing at all survives of a meeting that was to mark the beginning of the most important friendship either Frost or Thomas would ever have. A few days later, Eleanor Fargen surprised Thomas with a singularly direct question. "Haven't you ever written poetry, Edward?" Thomas let out a self-deprecating laugh. "Me," he said. "I couldn't write a poem to save my life." In Hampshire that winter, with Edward more or less permanently away, Helen Thomas turned to Eleanor Fargen for companionship. As they sat up late at night, Eleanor unburdened her feelings for Edward. "You know what I feel for him, don't you?" she asked tentatively. "You know that I love him." "Yes, Eleanor, I do." Eleanor delicately offered to withdraw from the Thomases' lives, but Helen would have none of it. For Helen had made a calculation that so long as she retained Edward's fidelity, then she would, she believed, retain him along with it. She felt sure that he would not develop a sexual attraction for Eleanor. These were confusing times for Eleanor Fargen. She had admitted her love to Helen and herself, but she was far from breathing a word of it to Edward. 3 days before Christmas, Thomas and Frost met again at St. George's Cafe. The meeting must have gone well, for Thomas would begin to invite Frost to stay with him at Balham whenever he was in London. Among their conversations that day would have been the news that Frost's friend Wilfred Gibson was moving out of the poetry bookshop for a cottage in Gloucestershire. Frost learned with interest of Gibson's new venture. He had never lived in a community of poets, and now the calling seemed irresistible. Later, the poet Jack Haynes gave a collective name to the individuals who gathered in Gloucestershire in the year before the war. Abercrombie, Gibson, Drinkwater, Brooke, Frost and Thomas christened the Dymock Poets after the parish which, for a time in 1914, became a part of each of their lives. Robert Frost moved there soon after his 40th birthday. In his notebooks, Thomas recorded warm days beside the River Leadon. The more they walked, the more their friendship deepened. Frost delighted in his friend's knowledge of wild flowers and bird calls, while Thomas could listen all day to his companion speak about verse. And they found a meeting of minds on their ideas about poetry, on speech rhythms and sound sense, on uncluttered diction, on cadence and the ear. "He is quite the most admirable and lovable man we have ever known," wrote Frost's wife, Eleanor. Consciously or not, Thomas was preparing a run at poetry, and now he put to Frost the most important question he would ever lay before his friend. Could he, Edward Thomas, possibly write poetry? Frost had no doubts. Edward Thomas had about lost patience with the minor poetry it was his business to review. It took me to tell him what his trouble was. He was suffering from a life of subordination to his inferiors. Right at that moment, he was writing as good a poetry as anybody alive, but in prose form. In June 1914, Edward and Helen Thomas set off from Paddington to visit Frost. At 11:44, the train drew up at Oxford. Haymakers toiled beneath the hot sun. It was 80 degrees in the shade. In his notebook, Thomas wrote, "Then we stopped at Adlestrop. Through the willows could be heard a chain of blackbird songs at 12:45, and one thrush, and no man seen, only a hiss of engine letting off steam. Stopping outside Camden by banks of long grass, willow herb and meadowsweet. Extraordinary silence between the two periods of travel. One man clears his throat. A greater rustic silence." Reviews of Frost's collection north of Boston began to appear. Abercrombie was warm, Gibson less so. I am inclined to wonder at times if, in his determination to avoid artifice, Mr. Frost has not discarded too much. Frost feared his literary venture might result in failure, but his fortunes were about to change. "This is one of the most revolutionary books of modern times," Edward Thomas declared, "but one of the quietest and least aggressive. These poems are revolutionary because they lack the exaggeration of rhetoric, and even at first sight appear to lack the poetic intensity of which rhetoric is an imitation. The metre avoids not only the old-fashioned pomp and sweetness, but the later fashion also of discord and fuss. In fact, the medium is common speech." Frost was delighted. At last he felt understood, endorsed by a man whom other men listened to. "He gave me standing as a poet," Frost acknowledged in 1921. "He, more than anyone else." On the 3rd of August 1914, Edward and his son Mervyn set off for Gloucestershire by bicycle. They rode northwest, breaking their journey in Wiltshire. Soon after passing Swindon on the 4th of August, the twin brass domes of the Hooter at the Great Western Railway's engineering works let out 10 extended bellows that carried for miles. Britain was at war. That month, Frost and Thomas continued their pattern of walking and talking, and as they did so, something seemed to be shifting in Thomas's mind. Thomas jotted in his notebook, "It seems foolish to have loved England up to now without knowing it could perhaps be ravaged, and I could and perhaps would do nothing to prevent it." A new sensibility was emerging. The war was 3 weeks old, and for the first time he was imagining his countrymen abroad, sharing the same moon as he. He had no care for the politics of the conflict, but his mood was troubled by a different kind of awareness. He was weighing the worth of the land beneath his feet and the way of life that it supported. What would he do if called upon to protect it? Would he do anything at all?
Now All Roads Lead to France by Matthew Hollis was abridged by Richard Hamilton and read by Tobias Menzies. It was produced by Emma Harding.
BBC Radio 4 Extra.
It's 3 o'clock. Hello, Jim Lee here with the 60-minute drama, and it's the continuation of The Wings of the Dove by Henry James, his 1902 story about an American heiress stricken with a serious disease and her effect on the people around her. Then at 4, Mel Gedroych feeds the meerkats with her daughter Floss at Edinburgh Zoo and wishes a very happy birthday to the Alien and Avatar star Sigourney Weaver. And then at 8 o'clock this evening, Paul Temple becomes embroiled in the Spencer affair. Now, part two then of a former classic serial, The Wings of the Dove. And with Merton back in London, Millie hopes that he will be the one great passion in her short life.
Extraordinary.
I told you, I could bring you anything.
Susie, look.
Matcham House. One of the greatest houses in all of England.
Oh, it's beautiful.
You have yet to see its treasure. Drive on. Are you ready to meet charming new people? Can you bear all the chit-chat?
Can you, Mark?
I'll take your arm to steady me.
No, you look after Susie.
Millie, my dear.
Maud.
Isn't this perfect?
I think the day is perfect.
Summer, full flush.
Look at these pictures.
Look up. The cupola is hand-painted.
It is incredible, as if the sky is moving.
You are incredible, my dear. You look incredible.
I feel quite bland amongst all this splendour.
You must stay with us, Millie. Anything else is impossible. You don't know yet, but you can do
anything. It's as if the sky draws you upwards.
Come outside. It's astonishing. And they put the fountains on and a marquee. Could it be more sublime? Iced coffee?
Oh, I need this. Mm. Now, absolutely perfect. There's Kate. She's the handsomest thing here.
Yes, she certainly is striking.
I wonder how one would place her if one didn't know her.
Oh, one could see she was made for great social uses.
I'm not sure I know what that means.
She's a luxury to be taken about the world.
She's always so right. She is lovely.
You must help me with her, Millie.
With what?
Oh, 100 things. Susie said, you know,
Mr. Densher.
No, not here. Here is too perfect. Today, we've come into a fairy tale.
How beautiful she must look to him.
You're all swimming together in the blue, my dear. Oh, look at Mark.
He passes and repasses.
He is our skein of silk, ever in reach of the embroiderer's hand.
She thinks I did this for her. or because of her.
What's he done with Susie?
But we know, don't we?
You did it because of me.
Probably dropped her off with some suit of armor.
Let her think what she will. You and I are different.
You must stay with us. You must make your home with us. You must let us all take care of you a little. You and Kate together, you can do anything.
Millie, have you seen the picture in the house? The beautiful one that is so like you?
Oh, I've only seen some incredible old masters as we came through.
You are the image of this wonderful Bronzino. You must have a look. May I borrow Millie?
You already have, haven't you?
Lord Mark?
Here we go.
Oh, you'll excuse me.
Of course.
I was just wondering if you would construe this place as a palace.
Well, if they don't tear it down in the next 50 years, it must be.